Let's do this. The Cult of Hockey podcast by the faithful and for the faithful. I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal, and I'm here today with Bruce McCurdy. Welcome, Bruce.
Hey, David. How are you today?
Yeah, good. I'm good today. It's a nice day. Seems to be, I haven't been out yet, actually. This is the God's honest truth, but there's a fence to paint and, of course, blog posts to write. I wrote one earlier today that we're going to start off on. This comes out of some speculation on Oilers Now, Bruce, about Taylor Hall, and it's definitely in the super speculative category because they're talking about where Taylor Hall might end up 2 years from now, essentially after his contract runs up. And he could break his leg. A lot could happen in 2 years, Bruce. A lot could happen. He's the hottest. You know, Taylor Hall is so hot right now. He's the hottest commodity in the NHL, and of course his contract is coming up, a great contract by Steve Tambellini, by the way, the 7 year, $6 million per deal, or was it eight?
Seven and, times six.
Yeah. That he gave all those contracts out to Eberle, Nugent Hopkins and Hall. And I would say all three of those deals have proven to be ranking from good to brilliant.
I think McT did the RNH deal because they were 1 year apart, of course, because they were drafted they were signed at different points anyway, and Nuge was 1 year behind. By then, that would have been 2014, and by then McTavish was in. But the Hull deal certainly, I don't think any of those deals is that bad, to tell the truth. Like, those guys all delivered to some extent, you could argue, I suppose. But the Hull deal, I mean, he's outperformed for sure. And especially when you put last year on top of what he'd done prior to that, he's, for $6 million, MVP performance for $6 million he's already paid his salary for this year.
Earned it. So the latest speculation on Hall comes because of something that he said, and he was talking at Hall. I actually didn't find the source of it, but Brendan Ulrich read the quote on Oilers Now, mm-hmm. and here's what Hall said. Quote, "Hockey has been a sport for a long time where guys are so loyal to their teams, and I think in a lot of cases teams aren't as loyal to their players, right? Teams are much more inclined to treat it as a business than players are. I'm not sure if that's going to change now or not. You saw John Tavares make a decision, and I have a lot of respect for that." So essentially Hall's saying Tavares, who left the Islanders, he's all, that's cool with him. Like, he's got a lot of respect for that, which I guess if Connor McDavid were saying that, and his contract was 2 years from due, that would get me worried a lot if I was an Oilers fan, if McDavid made a comment like that, because you can take it as just, well, he's just supporting his NHLPA brethren and making a just a comment on someone else's situation. But you can also read into that this is clearly something that I think is I'm like, you could read it as, I am aware teams can screw players over, mm-hmm. and I am aware that I can fully make this own decision by myself. That's how I read it, actually. How do you see the comment?
Well, it's only simple business. I mean, you're in a situation where you're in what's going to be a free market, and then, you know, that's how it's described. Of course, that market is anything but free. It's such a misnomer. But it's open to free speech, and Hall is saying, you know, he's throwing out there, hey, New Jersey, you want to re-sign me next 12 months from now? You better be coming to the table with a real nice looking offer, because there are other options out there. I mean, it's just Taylor being Taylor. I think he speaks his mind. I think.
Yes. So Bob Stauffer of the Oilers organization then went on. He was on Oilers Now today, and he talked about this. And he said, here's Stauffer's quote on, "If I'm Taylor Hall, if I do go to free agency, I'm looking to go to a place that has a couple great centers." Geez, I wonder where that is, Bruce.
Pittsburgh. That's Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I wonder where else that might be. Then he says, Bob says, "Taylor learned a tough lesson in Edmonton. We've had players who didn't want to play here. Taylor wanted to play here. Taylor wanted to be part of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then Stauffer goes on to assess, you know, New Jersey had a really quiet off season. They've got a lot to prove. They got to prove to Hall that they're going to get some stuff done. And then Bob talks about how Ryan Smith came back. Wendell Clark came back to Toronto three times and Chris Nyland returned to Montreal. And he says, in regards to Hall coming back to Edmonton, there's an old saying in life, never say never. We saw Mike Comrie come back.
Yeah, that's right. We saw Kevin Lowe come back. We saw Glenn Anderson come back. We're going to see Kyle Brodziak come back. I mean, there's a lot of guys that have rolled through town and then come back after a period of several years.
So what do you think, Bruce? What do you make of Stauffer's comments? And what do you think of the idea of Hall coming back here eventually?
Well, he likes it here. I mean, I'm not sure how much he likes the management to trade him away. I'm not sure how much they like him. You know, I mean, there's bridges that have to be crossed, right? Perhaps built and then crossed.
It would be unlikely. We don't know. Maybe things are cool between him and Shirelli. I mean, Shirelli's always been complimentary towards Hall since the trade. But it does sound like Hall was, especially the year before last, he sounded pretty bitter about the whole thing and obsessed with it and unhappy with it. But maybe that was something that he needed to go through in order to become the player he is today. So maybe the fact is we have no idea, I guess, how he feels about Shirelli or McClellan. And if they were still around, and I would say that's about 50-50, if that at this point, that they're around in 2 years.
Right.
There's some people who are saying, okay, let's dare to dream. Let's get excited about this. And so here's the argument in favor of Hall coming back, Bruce. Mm-hmm. It's the NBA. So there's John Tavares, who chose Toronto. This is a mm-hmm. first indication of NHL players building NBA style Golden State Warriors super teams mm-hmm. and going full Kevin Durant and picking one team and building it. And there's also the fact that McDavid and Hall were roommates, presumably are good friends, that in fact Edmonton does have two good young centers under contract for a long time. Mm-hmm. So it's really easy to believe that excellent hockey players would want to play in Edmonton right. going forward if in the next year or two this team can start winning. And I expect that to happen, although that's not a sure thing. You know, it's also the case, Bruce, and I'll just end with this. The Ice District is, I think, going to be a big attractor to players with the two condo skyscrapers right. they're building there. It's going to be kind of like a fantasy island kind of situation where you have these luxury condominiums with great views, absolutely spectacular views of the North Saskatchewan River Valley, and all kinds of high-end exclusive restaurants and bars to hang out within. You can wear your pajamas and walk to practice. And I think that that for someone in their 20s,
mm-hmm.
Now Hall will be in a little different situation. Who knows? I don't know if he's married or if he's getting married, but for a lot of players, at least I could mm-hmm. see that actually that whole thing as players move in there. And I understand some players are going to move in. My understanding is the McDavid's moving into one of those towers.
It does make sense.
This could be quite a, like in terms of living here in the fishbowl, that's one hell of a nice fishbowl to live in.
Well, so, just kind of keeps you out of the large, maybe places I don't want to go to, you know, like I can really live in a focused area.
And have bars and restaurants.
I can't think in terms of lifestyle the way a hockey player thinks. So I don't have much useful to add. What I am getting out of this, though, is that dare to dream that this year the Oilers suck so bad that the management gets fired so that the new management can go out and entice Taylor Hall to come back here. And this is the dream, right? Okay. I'm going to take a hard pass on the dream. And I mean, Taylor coming back in 2020, hey, I'm all over that. But how you get from here to there, if it requires new management, then that requires 10 miles of bad road before you get to that point. And I don't want to lose another season, God. Damn it, I want to this season. Come on, boys. Enough of this.
Yeah. I don't see this as a, I actually think it's, I think Hall with his big personality, Bruce, like he really is a big personality and becoming more so all the time. I see him, the most likely place he's going to end up is New Jersey, because that's usually what happens. And I think it's most likely what's going to happen with Taylor Hall. But in the event he did leave, I could see him going to Chicago or LA or New York, like one of the biggest American cities, that kind of stage and being attracted to that kind of stage. And at least one of those teams will probably by 2 years from now would be attractive enough to sign with. So that's where I, when I think of Taylor Hall and the perfect fit, you know, Dallas, Los Angeles, Tampa Bay, somehow those teams resonate more with me than Edmonton does, especially with Edmonton's history here. Although again, there's the history of McDavid, which is a, and there is McDavid's presence, which is a real strong countervailing force.
1 year history with McDavid, and basically the rest of his career, Hall's been the number one man on his team. And I think he'll be looking for a team, and a team will be looking for him. That'll make him the number one man on his team, not anybody's sidekick, due respect to. And McDavid, you know, even Hall, good as he is not McDavid. So, I see that kind of as working against it. And I mean, there's 30 other teams out there, right?
The owners also, Bruce, like if you're going to, there's the cap, right? This is why the super team, is why the super team argument kind of falls down at the NHL level. What that entails is a lot of players taking discounts. So is Taylor Hall actually going to take like a $3-4 million a year discount to come play in Edmonton? And if the owners were going to splurge on a player, they've made their decision on McDavid and Draisaitl. And I would personally pick Leon Draisaitl over Taylor Hall even today. And I know that that's not going to be a popular comment with a vast, maybe a vast majority of Oilers fans, but Draisaitl is a center. And we're going to get into this in the second part of the next item that we're going to talk about, but he is a center. He's a big center. That is such a valuable piece in terms of the NHL playoffs and winning the Stanley Cup that, that's why I favor Draisaitl over Hall. And to balance that out though, I don't think it's the high priced winger. It's going to be, you might need to pay a lot of money to get a top defenseman. And I think that's might still be something the owners will do. There's also the possibility that Jesse Puljujärvi and Kyler Yamamoto will develop and become options on the wing. They're going to cost some cap space to keep, but also kind of solve the problem that everyone's feeling in Edmonton. I think this is what fuels the Hall fantasy in Edmonton a little bit is the problems on the wing, obviously, but those could be, by Christmas time, we could be saying, look at Puljujärvi, he stepped right up, or Yamamoto has stepped right up. And that idea that the Oilers really, and Nugent Hopkins is crushing it like he did in the last month, and we're cool on the wing.
Yeah, well, one team that I look a little bit as a model for Edmonton with the two super centers is, of course, Pittsburgh with Crosby and Malkin. And we only wish that Draisaitl will become anywhere near Malkin, but you know he's heading in a good direction. I mean, as number two centers go, when you have a 22-year-old guy with 270-point seasons under his belt and 7 years to run on his contract, whatever the value of the contract is, I mean, it's part of the equation. But the fact is, he's locked up here long term. Still a young player, going some ways away from reaching his full potential. And Hall, of course, now he's shown his full potential, and that's as MVP of the league. So that's pretty good. And he's got a cheaper contract, but it's only got 2 years to run on at this point. And the next one will be way more. There's no two ways about it. So what Pittsburgh did was they went out and they hired first time around, they brought in Marian Hossa as a veteran. But then a number of years later, after they'd had some not much success for 6 or 7 years, they traded for Phil Kessel. And that's a first-rate top-line scoring winger that didn't even necessarily have to play on their top line the way Pittsburgh had it set up. And that really put them over the top. They won two cups after that, of course.
Did Toronto eat some of Kessel's salary, Bruce? Do you recall?
Yeah, they ate some fraction of it. And then,
Just Google that and see if I can find it real quick here. You know, the comparable, I don't think Malkin's a real super strong comparable mm-hmm. for Draisaitl. I think he's in a different, slightly different class of player, different kind of player. I think Anze Kopitar is a really good comp for Draisaitl. That's big two-way center who gets about 70 points a year, you know, 25 of those points on the power play, 20, 25 points on the power play, and the rest at even strength, and is a just a super defensive two-way and attacking center at
I think playing style. I was just looking for a team that had two big time centers on it. So
yeah,
that's the default to Pittsburgh. They won three cups with those two guys. I mean, that's obviously your ideal. That said, Kopitar has won two cups, so he's not a bad comparable if you're going to go down that road. But Pittsburgh did go out and get a big wing, but they also got a whole bunch of use out of guys like Connor Sherry, who's gone now, and Ryan Rust, and Jake Gensel, wingers that they brought in, put them on Crosby's line typically, and lo and behold, they became big-time contributors. And the Oilers got to find one or two guys like that somewhere on the wings and hopefully among the guys that are there now.
Okay, still looking for the Kessel information. You know, it's interesting. It's funny. Kessel's had such great success in Pittsburgh. And did he win the Conn Smythe the 1 year? And it's funny how people just rake the Oilers over the coals over Taylor Hall, mm-hmm. which fair enough. But how much do you hear Toronto getting raked over the coals? And wasn't that Shanahan for the Phil Kessel thing? I mean, in some ways, Kessel's had every bit as much success, certainly team success, as Taylor Hall. I mean, it's a different team, obviously, but Phil Kessel's been a hell of a player. I mean, he had about as many points as Taylor Hall this year, did he not?
Yeah, and, well, he got bad-mouthed by the Toronto media.
Yeah.
Kessel did. I mean, you want to talk about what happened to Hall here in some quarters? Well, look at what happened to Phil Kessel with all that BS about eating hot dogs and stuff. And I mean, all the guy's doing is putting the puck in the net and being your best player night after night. I mean, I don't know what you want, but he, we've seen it here too often, you know, best player on a bad team, and somehow the team gets hung on that guy, the performance of the whole team. And it's not fair, and it's never fair.
So Toronto retains $1.2 million a year of Kessel's $8 million per year cap hit, Bruce. So he
salary dump as far as Toronto was concerned, because their team was going nowhere.
Yeah. And so Bruce, let's move on to the next topic. We're going to talk about Leon Draisaitl, and then we're going to talk about the left defenseman in part of the Cult of Hockey prospect series discussions. Mm-hmm. Leon Draisaitl. So I wrote a post today, kind of eight things that he has to do in order to earn his $8.5 million this year. And I start out with the notion that he came close to earning it last year. And if he had actually helped drive the Oilers into the playoffs, he would have earned it. But I don't think he really did, because the Oilers didn't make the playoffs and he was part of the reason. But all eight reasons are really come down to one thing. And it's the idea that Leon Draisaitl has to commit to playing center. The coach, Todd McLellan, has to commit to keeping Leon Draisaitl at center. And Leon Draisaitl has to lead the second line to success and lead the group of wingers on that line, be a great faceoff man, be a great defensive player as the second line center on the Edmonton Oilers. That's how he will earn his money and get kind of everyone put away that notion, which really failed last year, I would argue, that he is in any way going to be, his future is as Connor McDavid's winger. Which I think harms the team more than helps the team.
Well, if I'm the coach, I'm looking at it like this, and I'm saying, Leon, we know you love playing with Connor. So here's the deal. Every power play, you and Connor are going to be on the same unit, right? 3-on-3 overtime, you're our first line. We're going to throw the two of you together over the boards as often as possible. Once in a while, we're going to put the two of you out there together 4-on-5. Give you a chance to attack on the penalty kill a little bit and play together. But 5-on-5, man, we need you to run a line, and Connor's going to run his own line, and that's the way it's best for our team.
Like, yeah, I would say to them,
you're lots of time together. It just won't show up in the stats because they're always 5-on-5, the teammate time, right?
Yeah, I would just remind them, like in the 2017 playoffs, Leon Draisaitl, you were the best center on this team. You at even strength, you have it in you to, in your own way, be as valuable as Connor McDavid at even strength. At in games and in series and when they at certain times, and that should be your goal, at least to be that kind of player and make that your goal. Anything he does, just think, okay, I'm going to get out there now and I'm going to take it to them as well. I'm going to carry the puck. I'm going to make plays. I'm going to be the guy and set a real high bar for him because I don't think this is putting pressure on Draisaitl. I think he can achieve that bar. I mean, Kopitar does it in LA. He's the man. And Leon Draisaitl can be the man, you know, he can be a number one center on the Oilers' second line. And that, in terms of the team winning, Bruce, it's crucial. It's absolutely crucial. And they need Draisaitl to fully buy into it and to do it.
Yeah, they do. He is critical to their importance. If I'm the coach, I'm trying to sell him on, Leon, we're counting on you to be a stud because we're asking you to do this, centering that line. Plus, we're asking you to be versatile and do all these other roles. Oh, yeah, we want you to take extra face-off duty, too, because you're the best we got at that. And just load it onto him and see where he takes it. He's certainly got the package of skills and size and everything else, you know, that you want to be taking on that big responsibility. And I'm not saying he's Mark Messier, but that was what they eventually asked Mark Messier to do. And he centered his own line. He played actually not that much with Wayne on the power play, but they did some PK together. They did, and they didn't have 3-on-3 overtime in those days, but they asked him to play big roles within the team with and apart from the superstar, both.
Yeah. And your point, Bruce, about you are going to be playing a lot with McDavid is well taken. He will be playing a lot 3-on-3 and on the power play, of course, where the Oilers are absolutely dependent on Draisaitl. I think his goal should be to be compete with McDavid at even strength. McDavid obviously is the best player in the world, but in the offensive zone game where everyone's kind of standing still, there's things to be said about Draisaitl over McDavid as a player. Standing still, Draisaitl is more able to puck protect. He's got a better shot at this point, and I think he's as good a passer, if not a superior kind of standing still passer. When you're moving, that's when Connor McDavid is the Sundance Kid, and there's no one better than when he's moving. Connor McDavid is absolutely deadly. And so the Oilers' power play should be Draisaitl standing still and McDavid moving.
He's pretty good at stealing and regaining possession of the puck when he's not necessarily moving that fast. Like, he does have great hands.
Who's that? McDavid, for sure. But
Draisaitl... if you say to him, hey, you want to pad your stats playing with Connor? Go out and score 30 points on the power play, man. Get another 5 in overtime.
Bingo.
Score 50 at even point, at even strength, and all of a sudden you're an 85-point scorer.
Yeah, and I think in a really good year, that's what Draisaitl might get, right? Like, he might get his – I think Kopitar, let me just look here. In his best season, which was actually last season, he had 92 points. Mm-hmm. And
that's not out of the realm of possibility.
And, point. Yeah, because I think Draisaitl should be able to get as much ice time as Kopitar because he'll be on the top power play. And and his next best year, Kopitar got 81. He's had a lot of years. Here's his point totals. And he's usually played most of the games. So he had 61, 77, 66, 81, 73, 76, 42 points in 47 games in the lockout year. 70, 64, 74, 52, and then 92. So that's, well, that'd be great to see similar numbers for Draisaitl over the next decade. And I think that's attainable.
That's a high bar, but I think you want to set a high bar for that guy.
Well, he's what, 76, 77 and 70? So he's right in that wheelhouse already.
Yep.
And he is playing on the power play with Connor McDavid, which is something that Kopitar never got to do. And although he did play with Drew, he does play with Drew Doughty, but of course Doughty's not the. It always amazes me Doughty doesn't get more points, honestly, on the power play. I always expect him to get more points than he does, but maybe I overrate his offensive ability just a little bit with Drew Doughty. Bruce, let's talk about the prospects now. And just tell me, who do we have on the Leftorium Junior class?
Leftorium, that's actually a shorter list than the Rightorium this year. We got Keegan Lowe at number 20, William Lagesson at 15, Dmitry Samarukov at 10, and Caleb Jones at 6. So nicely spaced out four of the top 25 and sort of, you know, in reasonable depth compared to the other positions. But among them, Keegan Lowe stands out as being the only one of the top 25 who isn't eligible for the current rookie camp that started for the Oilers today. The other guy missing, of course, is the unfortunate Ryan Mantha, who it sounds like his career is in serious jeopardy with an eye injury, and he's missing camp. And the doctor was already making comments like faint hope type comments today, and it didn't sound good. But of the other healthy top 24, Keegan Lowe is not at camp because he's a veteran. And every single one of the other top 24 is young guys, and most of them are like under 22. The whole top 10 is under 22.
Delagason, I think, is 22. And what's Samarukov's, what is he, 19?
Yeah, he's back in junior.
And Jones is 21 this year?
Yeah. They're all Shirelli draft choices, except Lagesson. Lagesson's the only guy in the top 25 who wasn't a Shirelli acquisition. He was actually drafted the last year of Craig McTavish when Draisaitl went in the first round, and they traded away their second and third round picks, and they drafted Lagesson with the first pick in the fourth round.
So let's start with Keegan Lowe, Bruce. We saw him in Edmonton a bit. He seemed like kind of a tweener, AHL, NHL tweener to me. Like I was not convinced I saw any one skill that would make him an NHL player. But sometimes those guys can carve out a bit of a career in the NHL. What do you think of him?
Well, you want to have, I mean, the fact that everybody else is a young kid and he isn't is maybe a fact that's working in his favor a little bit when you're talking about call-ups. Now, there are a couple of other veterans in the organization that didn't qualify for our list. They're either too old or they're not rookies anymore by NHL standards. And the fact he's still a rookie is because he's only ever played four games at age 25. So he's a long shot by that. I mean, I really seriously docked him in my rating for the age thing. But in terms of the immediate short term, who's most likely to play games in the NHL this year? He'd be among the top three or four guys on that list that's apt to see some action with the team.
You know, when I think of Lagesson, I think he might surprise us, actually. If he, I mean, we've seen him in dev camp situations before. You may or may not recall him. I don't recall his play for Team Sweden. He played in the U20 tournament. So he was good enough to make Team Sweden, which is usually kind of stacked on defense, as a for the U20 team. But he played last year in the Swedish Elite League and got 19 minutes a game. Some of it on the PK. He's a 6'2", 190-pound guy who can hit hard and move the puck a bit. And he may we have him higher on the list than Lowe because he's 22 and Lowe's older than that, considerably older than that. But he may quickly move ahead of Lowe if he can show some real facility moving the puck. That's what the NHL game is really. It's really super crucial. So if he shows himself to be clever, smart, and effective with the puck, and then really able to handle himself defensively, we may see him this year as well for a few games. It's not especially with Sekera getting hurt.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking he's because he's just coming over to North America now, they'll probably want to slow play him in the AHL. But you're right, that doesn't mean he'll get zero games in the NHL. I mean, he'll almost certainly start the season down there. They're talking about him being on the third pairing. But I like his chance. You know, the Oilers got three Swedish defensemen in the system. And I don't know what it is about Swedish defensemen. They sure do seem to produce a lot of them, including arguably the top two defensemen on the Oilers team. And they've got they got these three guys, and we got them all ranked like 12 for Berglund and 15 for Lagesson, 16 for Persson. But any one of those guys could blow the doors off of that projection. Like, there's some real nice positive arrows for all three of those guys.
Berglund sure is getting a lot of really positive talk early mm-hmm. this year because he's playing the power play. We'll get into him, I think, on Monday. We're going to talk about the right D. Yeah, so Lagesson, he's played in North America, of course. So he's not unfamiliar. He played a couple of years of college hockey, I believe, right?
He's got a nice background, a nice range of background. And he needs a little minor pro seasoning to add to that. But then he'll have had a nice mix of experiences by then.
Yeah. So who else we got? Samarukov. Both you and I saw him at the prospect camp this year, and both mm-hmm. of you, both I recall, we were both really impressed with him. He mm-hmm. He can really skate. He plays a heads up game. He was good with the puck. He was making good decisions. Sean Patrick Ryan, the Oil Knight, wrote the prospect profile of him and noted there was some issues with consistency and kind of gap. Aggressiveness in the defensive end, getting him, he needs to be a little bit more aggressive, getting people's faces more, which is, you could say about every single one of these young defensemen, I think.
Well,
maybe not Lagesson, but certainly about when we get to Bouchard, Ethan Bear, Caleb Jones, that's one thing they all have got to work at. You can't play in the NHL if you can't hang in there on defense and get right in people's grill and stop them. And the Oilers have, you know, they have defensemen who struggle with that to this day, including Oscar Klefbom. And
Samarukov impressed me in the Billy Moore's Cup as being the guy, one guy on either team that was initiating contact, and he was stepping up and getting in people's grill a little bit. And mind you, he got burned one or two times on a bad pinch. You know, you do that too often and they're going to get around you once in a while. But I wouldn't call, he certainly didn't strike me as being unaggressive. Let's put it that way. Like he liked, getting right in tight to people. And I think Lagesson's the same way. He really likes to, you know, get right in on the guy's face and shoulder to shoulder and just play him hard and close.
Like, yeah, I said the same thing.
Like a defensive back, you know, the ones that play on hard on the line and challenge the guy all the way down the field.
Lester the Molester Hayes. My obligatory 1970s sports reference of the day. Maybe the 80s, Lester Hayes. Maybe we
number
creep into the 80s.
Hey, Oakland Raiders.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I was a little surprised to read Sean's review of Samarukov because what I saw was actually a pretty aggressive hockey player, mm-hmm. a little bit of a headhunter. Does that, you know, he seemed to be looking for opportunities
for hits, yeah.
to crush guys a little bit now and then, which is like, remember Darnell Nurse in that Jasper prospects game? How he just was, oh, God. He was just crushing people left, right, and center.
Holy terror.
Oh, he was like, you know, he was Eddie Shore for my obligatory 1920s hockey reference. And Samarukov, he doesn't have that kind of skating yet or physicality. He's not Darnell Nurse, but he's kind of like Darnell. Like when you think about his kind of, he's very athletic. He can really move on his skates. He looks like a raw talent. He looks like he can move the puck. He's kind of like, a slightly lesser, smaller version of Darnell Nurse, but in that category of player. And that category of player is pretty damn good, I think. I really like that kind of defenseman. So Samarukov.
If they can also, you know, if they're mobile enough that they can close those gaps and they're mobile enough to win races to puck, and then even if it's just a simple pass to get it going north, you know, there's room for that kind of player.
Indeed. Yeah, because when I was looking at the list today, I was thinking, ah, Samarukov, like, do I really think Caleb Jones is a better prospect than Samarukov?
Well, I was just going to get into that.
And I
talked about Jones.
I'm not, at this point, I'm not sure at all, actually. I can't remember how, I'm sure I ranked Jones ahead of Samarukov. Mm-hmm. And And just shows what a difference a year makes. Because a year ago, Caleb Jones, his star was a lot more ascendant, right? Because he was just coming off a really great year in major junior hockey, another one. Like he had just been going up arrows all the time, every year since he had been drafted with Caleb Jones, making the U-20 USA team and being kind of a heavily used player in the World Junior Tournament. But he took a step back this year, and I think he was injured, as I recall, a little bit. Yeah, he was in January. He missed some time, and he just had some development issues in terms of defensive play, reading the game fast enough and making plays at the HL level was a bit of a struggle for him, is the truth of the matter. And his coach talked about that all year long. I mean, I think I had in the profile of Caleb Jones, which I wrote, I found about three or four different quotes from Jerry Fleming, then Bakersfield coach, where he's all kind of saying, making the same kind of hint, like there's a little bit of problem with his reading and the speed of the game right now and his decision-making. So it sounded like it got a bit better as the year went on, but this is a huge year for Jones. He and Ethan Bear kind of entered last year even in the rankings, so to speak, real close. But
yeah, they've been neck and neck since they were drafted, almost at 7 picks apart in the second day of 2015. And I think they've been next to each other in our prospect rankings every year. And this year they separated all the way to number 4 and number 6. So they're still pretty tight. But Jones, you know, at the World Junior, when USA won the gold medal, he was the anchor of their second pairing, and Charlie McAvoy was the anchor of their first pairing. Now, Charlie McAvoy instantly made a huge impression in the NHL, and he was USA's best defenseman. Caleb Jones played a ton, and he played like 30 minutes a game for like back-to-back because they went 2 full overtime games, the shootouts, in both the semifinals and the finals. And he looked so good then that it was easy. So even when I hear he's slow reacting to the pace of the pro game or whatever. I mean, I know that he's got the physical speed and skill to overcome that, and it's just a matter of maybe he has to raise his reaction, you know, mental part of the game that little bit. But I'm confident that he remains a good prospect. As you say, though, in some ways, like we got him 6, 10, and 15, you could throw a blanket over all three of the guys we just talked about outside of Keegan Lowe. The three young guys, Lagus and Samarukov and Jones, and you know, it's you could easily say it could be any one of the three that makes it.
I agree, and it's funny because I almost expect to see more likely to see Lagesson than Jones in the NHL, but it could be just as easily Caleb Jones. Here's one of the comments from Jerry Fleming. This is what he said halfway through the season. It comes back with Caleb to just keeping the game simple and not trying to do too much, not trying to be a superstar or make the flashy play every night, moving the puck and picking and choosing your opportunities to make maybe join the rush. So he sounds like he was pushing and pressing and trying to do too much and just just struggled, you know. And
what he was describing, though, in terms of what was the ideal for this guy is exactly the way he played those two games for USA. Like I say, he just ate up the minutes. And it wasn't like he was making huge rushes with the puck. He was just winning races to it and passing it up to the guys, and they were taking it the other way. And he was doing it consistently and well.
Well, maybe it was just a matter of trying to do too much and just settling down a little bit and like, calm down, kid. Like, you can make the NHL if you play a certain way.
You might be Jay Bomeister, but
stick to what worked.
Do what you do best, and hopefully he'll figure it out. I don't see why he wouldn't.
Three pretty decent prospects though on left defense, Bruce. I mean, it's not like there's the cupboard's bare there either. And who knows? Maybe if we went back and we did podcasts 6 years ago, we would be equally optimistic about each position. Years ago as we are today, probably we would be, knowing us. But there does seem to be a little bit of depth and hope at each position here. And Jones, Samarukov, and Lagesson are all kind of players who, you know, one of them, it wouldn't be a surprise at all to see one of them stick as a third pairing defenseman in the NHL for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And maybe be a decent contributing player on a good team And it's these kind of players the Oilers are absolutely going to need to develop because they're not going to be able to hold on to everybody. I mean, if they succeed.
You got to have, and I touched on this at some length in the article that wrapped up our prospect series. You've got to develop some kind of core of guys within your organization, and they can't all be high first-round picks because there's not enough of them to fill a team. So, you got to have some. And you look at any good NHL team, you'll find a few guys that might be on the third or fourth line or the third pairing, but they've played for that team since they were drafted, you know, and now they're 26 years old and, you know, maybe they're no great shakes, but they eat up minutes and they help, you know, the general outlook of the team and stars, but you need both.
Bruce, I was just thinking of your post, and you had one line there. I was just speaking earlier about how we might be a little too optimistic now and then, which is, I think, the nature of talking about young players. You August, should be optimistic.
And it can't be optimistic in August.
but my rejoinder to that is the name that you mentioned in your post is Ziat Pygan. And
we got that one wrong, as it turned out.
You can't win them all.
We got most of them wrong in the sense that not very few of the guys we've reviewed over the years has made it all the way up for all the nice things we said about Curtis Hamilton and, you know, guys like that.
It was the weirdest thing, Bruce, because our prospect series came out last year and it was a little later finishing up. And just as we were kind of done, you know, Ziat Pygan was number three, I think, or number four. Yeah. Yeah. And just as we were done wrapping up, he played his first rookie game.
Yes.
And from the
and he looked terrible. And he
from the first time terrible. He stepped on the ice, like I had watched him play in the AHL for five or six games, mm-hmm. and he looked good. Mm-hmm. But from the first second he stepped on the ice in these rookie games against weaker players than AHL players, he was getting killed. He couldn't stop them on the rush. No, again and again and again, they rushed around him. So I was thinking, okay, that's just one game. We can't have been that wrong, but he never got up to speed. Yeah. I don't know what the hell happened with the guy.
He looked like he spent that whole summer eating Phil Kessel's hot dogs. Because he was in the spring when he came up with Bakersfield, he was closing gaps and stuff. And then against his, you know, in the rookie games, Penticton, which is a lower level in the AHL. And he was getting locked left and right. It was brutal.
And I'm thinking, oh, geez. We weren't the only.
He was gone back to Russia within like 6 weeks of that.
Yeah, I wonder
gone how. Out of the organization, like he went from number three prospect to gone in like no time flat.
Well, he had been in the KHL All-Star game 1 year. I mean, he's a 20 or 21-year-old. He had had this huge season, right, where he had stepped up as a very young player in the Russian league. He had had this huge season where he put up all kinds of points on the power play. Then I saw him in Bakersfield, like a slap shot. Yeah. He seemed to be skating well. Oh, man. Yeah,
well, I was going to say mea culpa on that pick, but usa culpa. I think we all kind of, we both, it was just two of us voting last year, and we got owned on that. That's how it goes. Anytime you're projecting the future, man, that's why I do astronomy, not astrology. Astronomy is time travel into the past. You look at what's already happened. Or you could project with fantastic level of confidence what will happen when the laws of physics are involved. Astrology, it's guesswork. And that same is with how many points is Oilers going to get this year? How many points is Connor McDavid? Well, that depends on this. And so that's why I always equivocate on it. Answers on those things. When I stick my neck out on a guy like Ziat Pygan, well.
Indeed. Indeed. There's no science about guessing the future in hockey. Or there's some, obviously.
There's
science.
There's arrows. There's positive arrows. Yeah. And red flags. So that's what I work on.
The thing is with hockey, is it injury? And the more you watch the NHL, you realize, look at poor Ryan Mantha. You know, like, you know, this is the thing. Injury plays such a matter. Look at Taylor Hall. Taylor Hall, like a year ago, he had another kind of Taylor Hall kind of year where he had been banged up and he got like 50 some points in 60 some games. And it almost fit with a certain trajectory of his career where you thought, is this guy ever going to, you know, truly break out? Like you could always see in a peak year, if he's at his best, he can score 90 points. But injury is such a factor. Leon Draisaitl last year, his injury. Yeah. Connor McDavid getting sick. Like injury is the, and I'm not saying Ziet Pygant was injured in any way. I don't think that's why we got that wrong. But injury, maybe it was.
Tyler Pitlick is a great example of a guy that was in the system that actually was blossoming in those 10 minutes here and there that he wasn't on the injured reserve. And then, of course, now he's gone to Dallas and he's played a perfectly healthy and a good season. And it was written, I think, in his case, he had to go somewhere else. I thought, I'm still rooting for the guy. But anyway, we'll, I guess we got the right defenseman left to go, and rookie camp underway, and we got games coming up next week. I'm hoping to get out to the games, the one in Red Deer. So,
is there a game on Sunday, this coming Sunday?
There's one in Calgary, Sunday. And then play Tuesday here against Grant McHugh and Nate, and then Wednesday in Red Deer against Calgary Flames rookies.
And in the Tuesday game against Grant McHugh and Nate is that moment when we all realize just how unbelievably deep the pool of Canadian hockey talent is, because a bunch of completely unheralded college university players will give the Oilers, the much heralded Oilers rookie, everything they can take and more, I'm sure.
They shut him out last year, 2-0. The Oilers couldn't get a sniff against Nate. It's not even a team. Nate McEwen combined team.
Why don't they play the Bears anymore? What's that all about? Like,
there's some kind of issue there, David. That we need one of the crack reporters from one of the local media outlets maybe to examine what's going on there. But something's some kind of falling out between the university and I think possibly Daryl Cates. I'm not sure what went wrong.
Well, maybe that'll be cleared up with Herber's going back to coach there. He's a former, but maybe it's at a higher level than that.
That game was a staple. I love that game. I went to 19 out of 24 games or something over the years, and it was just sad to me, because the Bears, that was a real nice bat match, right? It was almost the level of teams that had won almost the same number of games. And every year the Bears gave them a good test, and the Oilers gave the Bears a good test and a good gate, which they always need, because their season, they don't draw crowds like they get for that one game. So it kind of used to set up their program every year a little bit.
Certainly doesn't help if you can get 2,000 fans paying, what were the tickets? I don't know, 10 bucks, 15 bucks?
Yeah, they were reasonable, at least till the very end. And then, I'm not sure if that was part of the issue or not, but anyway, it seems to be down and out, for at least for now, and hopefully it'll get repaired at some future date, because I mean, the University of Alberta isn't going anywhere, and I don't suppose the Oilers are either.
Of course, the Grant McHugh University is also a university now, has a university team, and there's a close tie to the Oilers, and they use the same facility. Right. The practice rink there. I think, does the Grant Mac play their games there? On the downtown community?
Honestly, I don't know. It's not out of the question that they might. I mean, it's right there.
Yeah. All right, Bruce, let's leave it there. And thanks for talking.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everyone.
And in the meantime, and in between times, this has been another edition of the Cult of Hockey podcast.